Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Putting yourselves back in summer 2020, the racial reckoning, as people have been calling it, how did you feel in that moment?
I was very anxious all the time. I felt people were seeing my skin more. You could see, like, who was faking their activism.
Over the past year since, there's been a lot of conversations about race and racism. Now that the dust has settled, how do you think those conversations have went?
There's more talk about it, but there hasn't been much change.
It still feels like no one really cares.
Are you tired of the conversation? Are you tired of being asked about race and racism?
Yeah, like I'm just supposed to have all these answers to questions before I'm even asked.
It's not my duty to educate all the time. I feel like you should educate yourself and just not be a terrible person. My life isn't a talking point.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. There's this one detail in the grim story of Kyle Rittenhouse that haunts me. I don't know why it's this one. There are so many others, but here's the one that gets me. When Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed his first victim, a confused and scared man with bipolar disorder who had just been released from a psych ward, when a confused and scared but heavily armed Kyle Rittenhouse shot this man dead, the nearest bystander was a videographer from the Daily Caller. This is a far-right website, co-founded about 10 years ago by Tucker Carlson, that spent 2020 generally giving its readers the impression that a violent race war was underway. And sure enough, there they were, right at the front line, capturing the violence about which they had so often fantasized. So this week, with the breaking news of the Rittenhouse verdict behind us, and with all the hot takes having cooled, I want to revisit two conversations we had earlier this year that might help us understand how this awful case became a political talisman. When a set of ideas become prominent enough to generate a backlash, it's easy to lose sight of the original ideas. That's the point of a backlash. So the first conversation I want to revisit is about the anti-racist work that somehow, improbably, and to my honest surprise, snuck into the mainstream last year. The second conversation is an anatomy of the right-wing media machine that concocted a backlash to those ideas and that turned Kyle Rittenhouse into a counter-revolutionary martyr. I sat down with Ibram X. Kendi back in June to talk about his multiple best-selling books, including the books How to Be Anti-Racist and The Sweeping History Stamped from the Beginning. We talked about how and why anti-racist scholarship finally caught on and why he turned his own work into very popular kids' books.
I certainly, obviously, you know, the books for the adults are, you know, dear to me, but as you know, Kai, there's something about, you know, kids and young people learning anti-racist ideas so they won't have to spend their lifetime unlearning racist ideas or unlearning these notions that sort of divide us or rank us or cause us to imagine that certain groups of people are dangerous or lazy or unintelligent. The fact that just the beauty of a young person coming of age without that baggage.
Yeah.
it just excites me.
Did you do that on purpose? Had you always planned, I'm going to make these books into children's books, or did they just come to you?
No, it was not planned. It didn't really start until, I think, after Stamped from the Beginning dropped. And, you know, I was, of course, talking to people and talking about the book. There was so much feedback from people who were like, wow, I wish I would have learned this history of racist and anti-racist ideas, you know, when I was in high school, you know, when I was younger. And because, you know, if we're talking about people who are in their 30s or 40s or 80s, they're like, man, I wasted away so much of my life.
right.
You know, and I wish I would have learned it earlier. And so people would consistently be like, no, young people need to read this book. Mm. So the more people said that, the more I was like, okay, let's figure out a way to do it.
So, you know, sometimes I think about the guy sitting down to write Stamp from the beginning, you know, whatever, how many years ago that was. This is, you know, a massive book. It's certainly, you know, an impressive piece of scholarship, you know, but it is a piece of scholarship, you know, like it's not the kind of thing, frankly, in a book about races that normally you would expect to resonate in the way that it has. And I guess I also wonder, you know, did that guy see this coming, either this for you personally or this moment we're in where these kinds of ideas would be so, people would be so ready to engage with them?
So Kai, if you were to ask my wife Sadiqa this, she will tell you this story. So I might as well tell you a story.
All right.
In which, so I finished the book, Stamp from the Beginning. And, you know, I sort of printed out the entire book, you know, for her to read. And so she read it and read somehow like 500 pages in, you know, a few days. And after she finished with it, she said that this book, you know, is going to be a critical landmark book, and it's really going to reach people, and it's going to be big. And I got upset.
Oh, really?
Because I was like, do not, like, because I did not believe that, right? I just did not believe that people would be willing to really grapple with sort of this history of anti-Blackness and a sweeping history from, you know, an intellectual history book and, you know, that doesn't really pull any punches. I just did not think. And so, of course, she got upset at me for getting upset at her, rightfully so, right? And to this day, she hasn't let it down.
Because she's like, next time, believe me when I tell you something. I know what I'm
exactly
talking about. Well, it turns out she was right. A core part of your work is defining terms and defining the terms we use. And you say there are three kinds of ideas. There are racist ideas, there are assimilationist ideas, and there are anti-racist ideas. So what is a racist idea?
So a racist idea is any concept that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group. And then there are two kinds of racist ideas. You know, as you stated, assimilationist ideas and segregationist ideas. And the easiest way to understand the distinction between segregationist and assimilationist ideas is going back to the whole nature versus nurture debate. So segregationist ideas commonly state that, let's say, a particular racial group is inferior by nature, while assimilationist ideas connote that a particular racial group is inferior by nurture.
Right. And an assimilationist idea, to use in a good example of this, you in Stamp, you cite, for instance, and this might be surprising to some people, you say that Brown Board of Education, that ruling is an assimilationist idea. So thus a form of a racist idea. But why? Explain that as a way to illustrate what you mean.
So many social scientists at the time, including, you know, Mamie and Kenneth Clark, talked about the way segregationist was, to use the Supreme Court's term, retarding, which of course is a slur now, but retarding both Black and white children in different ways. But what the court found is that segregation is harming the Black child, not the white child. So, you know, and what it imagined is that essentially segregated Black schools were a problem because they undermine and harm Black children. But it didn't also say, the court didn't say, the ways in which segregated white schools were also undermining or harming white children. So then what happened is what? The problem became the Black space, the Black school, mm-hmm. and the solution became the white space and the white school. And so therefore the solution was, let's get rid of all of those Black schools and bus or transfer all those Black kids from those inferior Black schools to those superior white schools, and that will be the sort of solution. Meanwhile, Black teachers were like, what about us? You know, actually, we've been doing some good work around here. The problem isn't that. The problem is resources.
Yeah. And so an assimilationist idea in that regard is anytime you situate the problem as somewhere in Black people, you've gone awry.
Precisely. You know, but then this assimilationist idea says the problem is in Black people, but it can be fixed by Black people becoming more white.
Right.
And so that's why sort of this whole, let's sort of, you know, so long as these Black kids are going to these superior white schools, everything will be, you know, okay. While segregationist ideas would state, no, it's actually impossible to fix those Black people by making them white. Because they're like a different species, like dogs and cats. You can't make a dog a cat.
And that's the one we're all a little more comfortable with. We all know,
exactly.
We can spot segregationist ideas, the assimilationist one that gets away from us sometimes. And before we move on to the anti-racist, it's also, you have made the case that it's important to use the word racist, that we can't use some other word for that. Why?
I just come from the school where you call a bird a bird. Mm. But I also know that with other social ills in our society, like can we imagine sort of fighting the existential crisis of a pandemic without calling it what it is? Can we fight cancer if we're not willing to diagnose someone as having cancer because that person is going to feel devastated? No, I mean, in that vantage point, the person who receives the diagnosis recognizes that though I am feeling hurt, though I'm feeling bad right now, that doesn't mean that that person who diagnosed me is trying to hurt me. Mm. If anything, they want me to get treatment. And the first step is that diagnosis, even though it hurts people.
So then anti-racist ideas. What is an anti-racist idea? What does that mean?
So if a segregationist idea says that a particular racial group is inferior by nature, assimilationist idea suggests that a racial group is inferior by nurture. An anti-racist idea says, actually, no racial group is inferior by nature or nurture, that we're equals despite any sort of color differences or cultural differences. And if there are racial inequities in our society, they must be the result of systemic racism, not what's wrong or right about a particular racial group.
I'm talking with historian and best-selling author Ibram X. Kendi. After a break, we're going to get into some of the history that Ibram writes about. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. This is Regina, and I'm a producer with the United States of Anxiety. A few weeks ago, we asked you to share your story about a career shift later in life and what you learned from it. Thank you to everyone who sent us something. And remember, you can always email us your messages and voice recordings to anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks again. Here's one of the messages we got.
Hi, my name is Amy. I am 60 years old. I was laid off work 2 years ago due to COVID. I am a white woman. I am a librarian at the top of my field. I have won numerous national awards. I have been interviewing for 2 years. Several jobs that I have interviewed for have gone to people younger and less qualified than myself. Two things that I have learned that I think may be of interest. One is when you're laid off or fired from a government system, it's really, really hard to get back in and be reinstated. And the second one is something you've mentioned a lot in your podcast about taking things personally. I've always been prone to criticism, and I have really done that. And your podcast helped me with that. Thanks for your interest.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and this week we are revisiting two conversations from earlier in the year that I think help us process this moment with all of the heated debate over so-called wokeness. In June, I spoke with historian Ibram X. Kendi about the way in which his own work, including the best-selling book How to Be Anti-Racist, found such hearty reception in the months following George Floyd's murder. I asked him about the backlash he and other scholars have felt ever since.
I don't think people realize this, but the 1619 Project and How to Be an Anti-Racist dropped the same week.
Oh, wow. And, no, I lost track of that.
Yes. And you know, obviously, just a, you know, a huge admirer of the 1619 Project and Nicole Hannah-Jones's sort of creative vision and leadership of it. And it caused the American people to really grapple with their past, with slavery, with historical memory, you know, in ways that certainly no other project that I can think of, you know, did. And in 2019, the term anti-racist was not a term that was widely used. People were still fixated on this idea that they're not racist no matter what they say or do. So I think some of the backlash has to do with the incredible success, you know, of, and I'm mentioning, of course, Nicole and I, but there's so many incredible writers like yourself and thinkers and creators who have been able to reach people. And as a result, there's a greater number of people who are aware of the existence of racism right now than potentially at any time in American history.
Wow.
And so obviously it's a response to that, but I also think something else is happening. I mean, when you particularly, as a political party, or if your organizations or your power is wholly dependent on suppressing the votes of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, of creating scenarios in which white people feel aggrieved, if you traffic routinely in racist policies and ideas, then it's actually politically important for you to project yourself not only as not racist, but then to go after those elements and voices in society that is actually instructing people to understand what racism is and what it looks like. Because the more people understand racism, the more people will understand those racist policies and ideas and parties and institutions in our society. So it's almost like a protective mechanism, you know, for particularly some of these far right-wing forces, you know, in order to maintain their legitimacy among people who don't want to consider themselves racist.
It becomes kind of a funhouse mirror. The whole conversation feels like it runs through a funhouse mirror to where you have, I heard someone the other day criticizing critical race theory by saying, you know, hey, you know, you're painting white people with one broad brush and making this notion that white people have an essential trait, and that's racist. And I'm like, I agree. It's just become so bizarre, the whole conversation.
It is bizarre, and especially when that then is tied to my work, in which one of my fundamental arguments based in research is this idea that racist and anti-racist are not fixed categories. It's not something that's essential to human beings. And certainly, you know, I reject the idea that white people are inherently racist. And I've taken all sorts of heat from people because I talk about the ways in which even people of color can be racist. And so clearly it's not tied to a particular racial group. It's really tied to what are we thinking and what are we doing in the moment? Are we challenging racism, systemic racism, or are we upholding it? But then people are saying, oh, that critical race theorist is saying that white people are inherently sort of racist and evil. And so it's clearly they haven't read my work.
They haven't read the book. So let's practice some of that right now. Let's walk through some of that. Because I agree, it's your assertions about who can and cannot be racist have been, I would say, the most controversial part of your work, right? And so let's start at the beginning. One of the things you write about is literally the creation of the word race and the idea of it. People forget this is an idea that did not always exist. You track it to 1606 when it first appeared in a French dictionary. Tell us that story. How did the word race and the idea of race come into existence?
In 1606, that is really when people in Western Europe, from France to England, are traveling around the world. And there's this vast and growing amount of what was called travel literature and travel accounts, which they're coming to, of course, Africa and Asia, particularly people in Europe and certainly, you know, the Americas. And they're trying to sort of understand these groups that they're seeing. And the term race became a term in which they sort of used to describe these different, quote, groups, ultimately these races. And that term, though, because it was believed that different races were also different species, you know, of being. the term race was also connected both to animals and humans. So when people thought about races in 1606, they were thinking, yeah, you know, I have different species of animals, races, and different species of humans, races.
And then immediately began to then rank those races as a hierarchy, because the point of creating the race idea in the first place was to create racial hierarchy.
Exactly.
But Ibram, this then leads to this question about whether people of color can be racist, because within that racial hierarchy, we don't actually have power. We don't have racist power. So explain how we can then exercise racist power.
Sure. So we're correct when we say Black people as a group certainly do not have, first, proportional power to our makeup in society, nor do we, of course, have more power than white people. And that's as a group. And so in order to practice racism, which is structural and systemic, it's, you know, that involves a group of people. But what we haven't done, and this is what I probably could have done even a better job in How to Be an Anti-Racist, is recognize that racism is different than racist. So if racism is structural and institutional and involves groups, racist is individual. So the question isn't, do Black people as a collective group have power? The question is, does Clarence Thomas have power? The question is, does Daniel Cameron have power?
Yeah.
The question, does Ted Cruz have power? The question is, do that Black cop or Latinx cop or Asian cop have power? That's a different question. Do I, as an individual, have the power to resist racism? Or do I think the problem is Black people? So I'm going after Black people as opposed to using my power to resist racism.
And why is it important for you to make that distinction? Why is that an important distinction for people to get?
You know, people are always worried about, oh, well, you know, Ibram, this can be weaponized. You know, and what's going to happen is now, you know, you're just going to have white people saying, you see, like, the problem isn't us, or you're just as much responsible for this. Well, first, they're going to say that anyway. But I don't think what people realize is that when you make the case that a person of color can't be racist, those who want to maintain white supremacy, those who want to maintain racism, what they're going to do is foster and nurture and put in positions of power people of color who are going to institute the same racist policies, who are going to defend them with the same racist ideas. Why would they do that? Because then they know what we're saying, that, oh, we won't charge those people in the same way we charge the white people they replace because they're Black. So people know that. That's why, as you know, Kai, the most of the people who are speaking out and calling Black people inferior and talking about all the different ways in which Black people are a problem, many of those people right now, particularly from the right, are Black.
Yeah. When Ibram and I spoke in June, he had just launched a new podcast to have conversations about being anti-racist. And he opened it with an episode about ableism. I asked him why.
Well, first, it is something that's deeply personal to me. I have my brother, I have an older brother, Akil, who's a person with a disability. And I haven't ever really spoken about him and his experience and his experience as a Black man with a disability and the way in which he's faced not only racism, but ableism and its intersection. I also feel, to be honest, Kai, that I feel like a chapter in How to Be should have been on ableism, and that's one of my sort of biggest regrets. And then also Rebecca Coakley, who I'm talking to, who's, you know, one of the foremost disability rights sort of activists and advocates and champions in the country, who also has a racial lens. You know, I'm a huge admirer of her. If we're truly anti-racist, we need to be fighting against all forms of bigotry, because they're all intersecting with racism in the lives and lived experiences of people.
Well, you know, in thinking about intersectionality, I do then immediately go to gender as well. Where does gender fit into your How to Be an Anti-Racist framework?
To me, you know, gender is critical. You know, there are Black men who claim that they are defenders of the Black community or that they are, quote, fighters against racism. But in their mind, Black people are men. And I think my own growth, particularly in recognizing the ways in which I had internalized forms of anti-Blackness, you know, part of it, what was critical was intersectional theory and Black feminist theory. And I had not realized that. So on the one hand, you know, I read books that sort of describe racist ideas about Black women that are typically intersecting with sexist ideas. And I didn't realize, I believed many of those ideas. I had no idea that in many ways I was a Black male nationalist and I was really only thinking of how it was best for Black men. At the same time, I imagined that I was challenging racism. And so that oftentimes happens because, you know, we can disagree with ideas about our group of Black people and then agree with those ideas about Black women or about Black poor people or about Black gay people, and then simultaneously imagine that we're challenging racism.
Ibram and I spoke just before the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. So I also asked him to reflect on that history and its relevance today.
There's so many different things that I think are relevant, but probably one of the things that is most relevant to me is, you know, there are people who, you know, go to different cities and see, in too many cases, this sort of Black neighborhood as the neighborhood with the least amount of resources or, you know, higher levels of poverty and unemployment. And there's this assumption that it's because there's something wrong with those people. But then I think more and more people are thinking, oh, well, you know, also it's because of incarceration. Also, it's because of redlining. So I think people are putting pieces together, which is great. Those racist policies or platforms or series of policies contributed to that. But what also contributed to it was literally thriving Black communities were raised. And what happened in Tulsa happened in other places, you know, around the country. And so I always, when I think about what happened on Greenwood Avenue, it to me is a symbol of what happened all over this country, where somehow, some way, by the 19-teens, by the 1920s, you know, a few generations after slavery, that Black people were able to build these thriving neighborhoods. And when they started thriving too much, you know, that's when they were like individuals, right? Because when individuals too, in the South, when they gained too much land, that's when they were white capped, right? That's when they were lynched. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for us to certainly talk about racist policies, but also know that when racist policies have failed to keep Black people down, when they failed to keep Greenwood down, there was also racial terror around the corner. Mm-hmm. So many Black people have been harmed because of her excellence. And that is emblematic, you know, of African-American history, and we have to sort of break that cycle.
Ibram, thanks so much for this, sir.
Thank you so much, Kai, for having me on the show.
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, and we'll be right back with another conversation from our archives, an anatomy of the right-wing media machine that turned a troubled kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, into an icon. Stay with us.
We start where it began.
In the life of a captive, life never got better.
From the dungeons in Ghana to New England's primary slave port, Boston, birthplace of liberty, was also the first colony to legalize slavery. As our nation struggles with the question of reparations, we look at how this long overdue reckoning is unfolding in the city that sparked the American Revolution. From GBH News, I'm Soraya Wintersmith. Join me for What is Owed, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. Nicole Himmer is a media researcher and author of the book Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. I spoke with Nicole back in May, before the Rittenhouse trial, or before fantasies about critical race theory came to define Virginia's gubernatorial election. So we didn't cover those things directly, but her work nonetheless helps explain much about them and about the remarkable success Tucker Carlson and others continue to have in shaping American political discourse. We began with her own family's journey into the conservative media universe. So, Nicole, how did you get interested in this in the first place? How did you get invested in the world of right-wing and conservative media and sort of drawn to listening and watching and reading the conversation there?
I can remember the exact moment. I was home from graduate school in the summer of 2004, and I was in the car with my dad, and we were talking, and he was like, you know, my goal for you this summer is to get you to vote for George W. Bush in the presidential election. And he reached over, and he turned on the radio to Rush Limbaugh. And we listened to a lot of conservative talk radio that summer, and while it didn't change my vote in 2004, it got me so interested in the way my dad saw a connection between what we listen to, what media we consume, and how we vote, how we think about our politics. So I was hooked from that moment on, and when I discovered there was a history to all of this, it became kind of my life's work.
All right. What was that connection for your dad, at least, in particular? Why do you think that was so important to him? Not that he would tell you, hey, I've got some ideas for you, but like, here, I want you to listen to this thing.
I think because he found it so entertaining and compelling, and I'm going to say smart. My dad would argue back to the radio. So it's not that he swallowed whole cloth everything that he was hearing on Limbaugh and Hannity and these shows, but he liked being able to interact with it and wrestle with the ideas. And he thought that that presentation of conservatism was something that would get me intrigued.
That's really interesting, too, because this idea that there is a combativeness and a debate with what's happening is part of the draw, or was part of the draw for your dad. I think that's not how a lot of people think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we tend to, especially if we're not conservative, to think about these programs as kind of brainwashing. And I think that that robs the audience of these shows of their agency, right? They're drawn to these programs for reasons, and they pick and choose from what they hear, what they believe, and how it shapes their politics.
Yeah. Nicole, you recently published an essay on CNN with the headline, quote, "History Shows We Ignore Tucker Carlson at Our Peril." And we'll get into the details of that history in a moment. But just in the most basic sense, why do you feel like we should be paying attention to what's happening on his show now, as opposed to saying, you know, this stuff is just meant to troll me if you disagree with it, you know, and roll your eyes and move on? Why is it important to pay attention?
Well, it certainly is meant to troll liberals. That is part of his brand. But it's important because, well, first, as you mentioned, you know, Tucker Carlson is the most watched show on cable news. But he is also very much in touch with the turn that the Republican Party took under Donald Trump. And he represents a powerful wing of the Republican Party. And by listening to him, not only do you kind of understand where that wing of the party sits, but the kinds of arguments that are being used, and the kind of code words that are being used. You know, when he talks, he introduces a lot of white supremacist themes into his show, but then he frames them in ways that if you're not paying attention, you might not understand exactly the point that he's trying to make or the history that he's drawing on.
One theme he's repeated often is the white nationalist idea of the so-called Great Replacement.
Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it, that's true.
I asked Nicole to explain where this idea comes from.
So the Great Replacement theory is this idea that lax immigration laws are meant to replace white Americans with non-white immigrants. And the reason that I think it's important to understand this history is because in the mid-1990s, this was a pretty mainstream argument. One of the best-selling books of 1995 was a book called Alien Nation by Peter Bremelow. And it made this argument that if America was going to continue to be America, it needed to shut down immigration from non-Western European countries. It needed to protect the whiteness of the United States. And over the course of the late 1990s, Bremelow and those ideas started to get pushed to the fringe. In fact, he would go off to found a white nationalist website called VDare and become part of the movement that would become the alt-right. And seeing how those ideas flow back and forth from mainstream conservatism into the fringe and back again, I think it's important to understand that these are ideas that can easily cross over into the mainstream if we're not talking openly about the very racist ideas that underlie them.
Right. And I mean, so speaking of crossing over into the mainstream, I mean, Tucker Carlson has been saying similar things for a while now. I mean, really since he took the helm of Fox Primetime, which of course coincided with the beginning of Trump's presidency. Here he is again back in July of 2017.
Western civilization is our birthright. It makes all good things possible. Undefended, it collapses. And so we've got to fight to preserve it.
So it's not new. That was 2017. But is there anything different about what's been happening since Biden's inauguration that you have noted in this conversation, Nicole? Like any shift in the conversation, either on Carlson's show in particular or just in right-wing media more broadly?
But I think one of the things that is new is, you know, during the Trump years, all of the focus was on Donald Trump. And the reason people paid attention to Tucker Carlson was because of Donald Trump. Now that Trump is not really in the mix in the same way, Carlson's words, in a way, carry more power, more weight, because he is one of the leading voices of these ideas. Before it was Donald Trump, now it's Tucker Carlson. So he's getting, I think, a little more open about things. And is more visible precisely because he's not competing in a way with the president of the United States.
Right. He's got more airtime.
That's right.
Let's go to Joe in Miami, Florida. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. You know, I'm at VA. I'm in my 70s, and I travel across the country a lot. And this has spread like a virus over the last 30 years. Your guest spoke to Rush Limbaugh. I listen to 12 hours a day of hate radio on top of my NPR. I live in a community of tradespeople, retired law enforcement people, majority of whom would have been the backbone of the Democratic Party 30, 40 years ago. And all these folks vote Republican. They're good people, but they absolutely know nothing about what's happening in a timely fashion. They knew nothing about Sidney Powell refuting her assertion about election fraud. I don't know how we're going to overcome the Sinclair and Murdoch stranglehold on this country. I'd love to hear any suggestions on that while you're at it. And I thank you for taking the call.
Thanks, Joe. And Nicole, what is the cause and effect here? I mean, as you study it, do you feel like people watch these shows and it brainwashes them and they lose track of fact? Or is it vice versa, that these shows are serving an audience that already exists?
So it's both, that people opt in to listening to conservative radio. I don't think that there are a ton of people who don't understand on some level that they're listening to information from a conservative viewpoint, but that it can draw them further and further to the right, depending on what they're listening to. One of the things that the guest talked about was driving through the countryside and listening to 12 hours of talk radio a day and coming across people who don't know some of the basic facts of things that are going on in the country. And that's one of the big differences between conservative media in the 1950s and the 1960s, when it existed, but you couldn't have wall-to-wall conservative media. There just wasn't enough of it. It's not until the mid-1990s that there's enough conservative media that you can sort of silo yourself within it. And I think that that's a big difference, and it allows you to sort of cut yourself off from contrary information or to dismiss contrary information that gets into your bubble.
And is that surge in the 90s that you're talking about, where suddenly there became enough of it to sort of silo yourself off in it, is that owing to Rush Limbaugh's popularity? What was the change?
Yeah, Rush Limbaugh is a big, big part of it. So he goes national in 1988. And by the mid-1990s, there are all sorts of people who are emulating him, like Oliver North and G. Gordon Liddy. In 1996, you have the founding of Fox News, which is modeled off of talk radio, just like MSNBC is. So Rush Limbaugh's success pointed out that there was a big audience for conservative media, and that big audience could be incredibly profitable. And once he sort of was the proof of concept for that, lots of imitators came along after.
All right. Let's go to Rue on the Upper East Side. Rue, welcome to the show.
Hi. So I am an NYU student, so I go to a very liberal college. For a time, I lived with a Republican foster family. Where their own kids walked around with like Breitbart shirts. And so after coming out of that, going into my own chosen family, I turn on Fox News. So I know what the conservative narrative is, because I know that more often than not, there is at least a semblance of a narrative. And another reason I turn it on is so I can see what the opposite arguments are and see if I can come up to a different conclusion than what the mainstream progressive stance is.
And this is a common thing. Thank you, Rue, for calling in. I think this is a meaningful part of the audience as well for some of these outlets, is folks who genuinely are trying to get a balanced point of view. What about that, Nicole? I mean, if people are seeking a balanced point of view as a consumer of media right now, I mean, do you feel like, is there, put it this way, is there a distinction between what is happening in a space like Tucker Carlson's show on Fox and what is happening on MSNBC nowadays?
I think there is a distinction between them. And you could imagine a time in the future where there isn't necessarily. But, you know, the right has had its own media for a long, long time. And it's become part of what it means to be a conservative in the United States to consume conservative media. So you have this kind of built-in audience, this audience that is eager to tune in and to believe and to absorb a lot of the messages that are coming from these media. And these media have real power within the Republican Party in a way that MSNBC just doesn't. And I always use as the example of the difference between the two. You know, when Michael Steele, who was the head of the Republican National Committee, insulted Rush Limbaugh once, within like 48 hours, he's groveling with an apology because, you know, if you insult Rush Limbaugh, you insult the base of the Republican Party. You just can't really imagine something like that happening if, like, Joe Biden says something cross about Rachel Maddow, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't have the same kind of pull within the Democratic Party. And that's a real difference. There isn't as strong of a connection between the base of the Democratic Party and us, you know, overtly political media. Mm-hmm.
What about distinctions inside right-wing media at this point? I mean, there was certainly a time, as you point out, where there was a sharp difference between a show like Rush Limbaugh's, say, and, you know, a brainy magazine like the National Review, that there was a range of conservative thought. What is the landscape now, you think? Do those distinctions still exist?
They exist up to a point. I mean, there has been a real revolution within conservative media during the Trump years. The collapse of anti-Trump conservative media, you know, National Review prior to Trump's election had come out with a whole issue about why he wasn't fit to be president. And by, you know, a couple years into the Trump administration, it was functionally a pro-Trump outlet, maybe not as much so as other outlets, but there wasn't a lot of space for anti-Trump conservatism. And so there's been a kind of collapse during the Trump years of that more capacious conservative media of an earlier era. It could come back, but it hasn't yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the distinctions is, you know, so we're talking about this, we've talked about these sort of increasingly unapologetic white supremacy on a show like Tucker Carlson's, you know, and again, Fox Primetime remains the far and away ratings leader in cable news. So just take that in. But there's also the, frankly, lying and misinformation. You know, is this a cynical tool, or is there something deeper that's at play?
Well, it is a cynical tool in a lot of ways. There are fewer safeguards for stories that fit in with the ideology of the outlets, right? So something that confirms the priors of conservative media tend to get more lift and a little less fact-checking. But I think that the thing that goes deeper is that, you know, audiences for right-wing media trust that media because it's right-wing. And they trust stories that confirm their political beliefs. And even if those stories end up being wrong, the attitude tends to be, well, okay, so maybe that story wasn't right, but the idea beneath it was right. And that is where it gets kind of complicated, that fake news, as it were, or these false stories and conspiracies, they have a much longer tail because the attitude is, well, you know, even if some of the facts are wrong, the underlying idea is right.
Yeah. Is there a version of this that is circulating as you watch and listen and read that you've noticed that people should be mindful of that is like not just an individual untruth, but something that is really circulating constantly? And I mean, there's the obvious example of the election.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the election is the one to pay attention to because it serves a much broader political agenda, right? It's not just about the 2020 election. It's not just about the insurrection on January 6th, but it is fueling all of these voter suppression laws in Republican-run states across the country. So when you have kind of a big lie that is attached to a political agenda, those are the spaces to really pay attention to because they get extra power because they're so politically useful.
I saw reports that the Republican National Committee has been fundraising off of some of Tucker Carlson's more extreme outbursts also. I mean, have you tracked relationship between these sort of media moments and party fundraising at all? Is there a deliberate circle there?
Oh, there's very much a connection there. The Republican Party and conservative media are closely intertwined, and that was true prior to Donald Trump. But, you know, during the Trump years, Fox News in particular became just so closely interwoven with the Trump administration and with the Republican Party. You saw that with Sean Hannity having like nightly phone calls with the President Trump after his shows. There were a lot of behind the scenes conversations that were happening. And so, yes, I mean, there's a very close connection between the party and these media, which is not to say that Tucker Carlson, you know, calls up the chair of the RNC before he goes on to make sure that they have their fundraising letters ready. But the party knows that its base consumes this media, and so they target them accordingly.
Let's go to Tammy in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big Tucker Carlson watcher. I watched CNN exclusively for my adult life, and then I started to get very friendly with an African-American woman that I work with who is a conservative, and she turned me on to Tucker Carlson. And, you know, we have kind of water cooler talk every morning about what he talked about the night before, and she really kind of opened my eyes to the racism that she was feeling from the left about how, you know, African-Americans don't know how to get ID and they don't know how to use computers. And she found that insulting. So then, you know, we talked about how the left has a narrative. So I also, we had a big conversation with that Project Veritas undercover video came out, and the producer admitted that they do propaganda reporting for their own personal narrative. And I just wondered what your take was on that.
You're talking about the Project Veritas videos. This is a conservative media project, defines itself as investigative reporting. And they have been behind a number of sort of big gotcha stories, getting people on the left in various positions. That you're talking about them admitting
the,
to
the
have,
latest
just to clarify.
One with the CNN, yeah, the latest one with the CNN producer, when he did talk about there was false reporting and things that they did to make sure that Donald Trump, you know, would not get elected, and then making Joe Biden look better, making sure they didn't bring up maybe some of his gaffes or, you know,
okay,
whatever.
So
you know.
Thank you, Tammy. So, Nicole, I'm not sure the video that Tammy's talking about, but I am familiar with many of these Project Veritas videos that are repeatedly proven to be heavily edited and also full of misinformation and often lies. It sounds like there's one I don't know of. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in general, can you sort of talk about the role that outlet plays if you're familiar with them?
Yeah, so Project Veritas, I mean, you're right that they're often heavily edited, but they create these powerful visual films that spread like wildfire across conservative media. And that connection there with Tucker Carlson is interesting, right? Because it speaks to the way that conservative media work as an ecosystem. So a Project Veritas video doesn't just live off in the wilderness on its own, where you have to like track down James O'Keefe in order to get a copy of it, but it's played regularly on Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and on talk radio. And it becomes kind of a network of authority because you hear so many people talking about the same video and you hear the repetition of it again and again that it becomes a pretty potent and powerful political weapon, even in the case of some of O'Keefe's videos that have been proven not to be what he proposes they are.
We got to wrap up, but I wonder, you know, for somebody who has spent, you said since 2004, watching and studying conservative media, I would find that to be dispiriting about the state of our politics and the state of our political culture. How does it leave you? What's your takeaway from doing that work?
Well, I think that it's important work. I'm not going to say that it is always heartening, but I think it's so important to understand the role that media outlets play in shaping our politics and making sense of where they fit in our political culture and in shaping the outcomes of our elections and shaping the way people see the country and see the world. So I find it pretty edifying work on that front because it makes me feel like I have a better sense of what's going on, and there's a power in that.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outerboro Brass Band. Mixing by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frohman, and Kusha Navidad. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or by sending an email to anxiety@wnyc.org. Love to get your voice memos there on anything you have heard. And as always, please join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.